headlines this hour. An Israeli minister's recent visit to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound sparks condemnations and calls for a UN Security Council meeting. Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei criticizes the West capitalist system as male-oriented and ignorant of women's rights. Also in the headlines, the U.S. Congress is thrown into chaos as the Republican Party's candidate to become House Speaker fails to win the support of hardline members. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. It's good to have you with us. The chorus of worldwide condemnation is growing over an Israeli minister's provocative storming of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. The United Arab Emirates and China have called for a UN Security Council meeting. The council is expected to convene on Thursday. Germany has also urged the Israeli regime to stop deliberate provocations. It's rejected unilateral steps that endanger the status quo on the compound in Al-Quds. Several countries, including Iran, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, have already joined the Palestinians in denouncing the intrusion by Itamar Ben-Gvir. The Palestinian leadership calls it a dangerous escalation and part of Israeli efforts to turn the shrine into a Jewish temple. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas regards the move as crossing a red line. Even some within the Israeli regime, including opposition leader and former Prime Minister Yair Lapid, have warned that such moves could lead to more violence. The Protestant cemetery in Al-Quds has witnessed acts of vandalism and desecration of dozens of graves, reportedly by Jewish extremists. An archbishop who is the cemetery's caretaker has called for measures to stop similar sacrilegious acts.
When we discovered that more than 30 tombstones and crosses were smashed to pieces by at least two Jewish extremists, I ask that an action will be taken for the perpetrators to be put to law, and there will be a lesson for others, you know, not to take this lightly. And we as a church and as owners of the cemetery will make all things possible to ensure that things and the acts of vandalism like this will not be repeated again. This is the one, because, like, whether they are from this group or that fringe or that group, at least, you know, the narrative is one, and that is hatred speech. And this is what we are against as a church.
The cemetery security camera footage showed two men vandalizing the site while wearing Jewish attire. Israeli police have launched a probe. That's why law enforcement and local officials are facing criticism for inaction toward the blasphemy. Back in December 21, church leaders warned about frequent attacks against Christians by fringe radical groups in Al-Quds. People converged on the Iranian city of Kerman, the hometown of the country's top anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, to pay tribute to him on the third anniversary of his martyrdom. Mahdi Abbasian has more.
Crowds of people who traveled from across Iran to the city of Kerman, the hometown of the country's late anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Men, women, children, thousands of people from different walks of life converged on the city to commemorate the third anniversary of General Soleimani's assassination and to pay tribute to a man they venerate as a hero.
I've traveled from Khuzestan to Kerman. We came here to show that the path of General Soleimani continues.
3 years after his assassination in a U.S. drone strike near Baghdad Airport, people are still filled with an overwhelmed sense of loss as they viewed the late general as a man who fought against tyranny and defended the oppressed.
He didn't just care about his own country, but he had a wider approach. In fact, he wanted peace and security for all people across the world.
While the enemies of the Islamic Republic of Iran targeted General Soleimani and killed him, his ideology is still alive and has had an impact not only on Iranians, but also all the freedom-seeking people of the world.
Killing Qasem Soleimani does not mean that his ideology was killed. His ideology was still alive. This shows that Qasem Soleimani is still alive, as his ideology, the people, we as youth are still going in his path.
Also, the presence of the youth in the memorial ceremonies and rallies in Kerman to venerate General Soleimani was noticeable.
I came here because of Haj Qasem, because he fought Daesh to make sure we live in peace and security. I love him so much.
Haj Qasem is a very popular figure among people due to his courage, kindness, and selflessness.
The younger generation respects and honors General Soleimani's school of thought, which revolves around serving people with selflessness.
The U.S. assassinated Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani because he foiled America's vicious plots in the region, but it was a strategic mistake. The martyrdom of General Soleimani pumped fresh blood into the veins of resistance and encouraged millions to follow his path. Mahdi Abbasian, Kerman.
Describe the West capitalist system as a patriarchal one, which he says the capital is more valuable than humanity. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei says the West considers humanity as capital, and therefore those who invest more are more valuable. He called that system male-oriented, where women's rights are often being ignored. Referring to women's working conditions in those countries, the leaders said currently they receive lower wages than their male counterparts. That indicates their exploitation. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks in a meeting with a group of prominent Iranian women. The meeting was held on the occasion of the birth anniversary of the daughter of the Prophet Muhammad. The day is designated as National Women's and Mother's Day in Iran. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. A base housing American troops illegally deployed to Syria has come under a fresh rocket attack. The U.S. military says two rockets have hit the base in eastern Syria without causing casualties or damage. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack. The U.S. has for long stationed forces and equipment in eastern and northeastern Syria without the Syrian government's consent. Washington claims that its military presence in the energy-rich region is aimed at preventing oil fields from falling into the hands of Daesh terrorists. Damascus has repeatedly called on the U.N. Security Council to end Washington's military presence in the country. It considers the deployment illegal and aimed at plundering Syria's oil and other natural resources. Let's bring in Fra Hughes, a journalist and author and activist who joins us from Belfast. Fra Hughes, welcome. Taking a look at what has occurred here, it puts into question once again the U.S. presence on Syrian soil. Now, the reasoning that's given by Washington is that it has to be there to fight these Daesh terrorists, and at the same time limit Iran's influence in Syria. When it comes to fighting Daesh terrorists, let me ask you that. U.S. has been there for years. Why isn't it eradicating the terrorists from that region if it's there for that purpose?
Yes, the U.S. sees itself as the only superpower, basically, that's been left in the world. It has spent the highest amount of GDP than any other country. In fact, many countries combined on its military infrastructure and its exploitation of violence, military occupation, and war throughout the globe. There are many, many, many. There's a proliferation of American illegal military bases in Syria brought about from 2014 onwards when Obama became the president. So there is the firepower, but there is not the willpower, there is not the political follow-through by the American administration to deal with Daesh. Many people believe Daesh was created by America, by Britain, by Israel, and by other parties whose only concern was the regime change operation in Syria. I've always believed that if Syria had fallen, that I believe the Caucasus would be next, that they would send us fully armed, if not fully trained, a horde of malcontents, thugs, murderers, and terrorists onto the borders with Russia. So America has no intention of defeating Daesh and never has. It is all about occupation and the balkanization of Syria. It is about stealing the wheat and stealing the oil resources for financial gain. These resources belong to the Syrian people. If they're worried about Daesh, they could simply leave, and the Syrian Arab Army and its coalition of partners would certainly clear out Daesh, and those oil fields could return to full productivity, and where the monies and where the revenues are spent on rebuilding Syria, strengthening the Syrian Arab army, and bringing humanitarian aid to those who have suffered for more than 12 years for the war on Syria, led by the West, very similar to the war in Ukraine and the coup in 2014 on the people of Donbass. So there's no political will to tackle Daesh. It's a smokescreen, literally, to steal oil revenues, to steal the wheat revenues, to starve the people of Syria, and to cause fuel crisis in order to help continue with the Western plot for regime change, which has utterly failed because Russia and because Iran and people like the great martyr General Soleimani came to the aid of the people of Syria, including Hezbollah in Lebanon. This has been a game changer and has prevented Syria from falling under the imperial kosh, and they have been able to stand up against this Western intrigue.
What do you make of the rapprochement that's going on between countries that were on the opposing side of Syria, who were really after, with all their might, I must add, to remove the democratically elected president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, who are now embracing him, like the UAE, we hear also the Arab League, certain members, and the most recent one, which either is in the works, and one piece of news I read that has been scheduled, and that's Turkey, where the Turkish president and the Syrian president Bashar al-Assad may meet. Not confirmed, so but it shows that there's a movement towards that. What are the reasons for that, do you think? And this comes to the dismay of the U.S., by the way.
Yes, well, I think Russia is playing a pivotal and crucial diplomatic role in the background. I think that while some countries were more than willing to see the Syrian Arab Republic fall, to see the Ba'ath Party destroyed in Syria, I think they have come to the realization that Syria is standing tall. Syria will not be defeated. Syria has regional military backers who are going to stand with them. They will stand together or they will fall together. And I think the fact that Turkey is now talking about removing all the Turkish troops, which are in I think it is northern Syria, if they were to remove them and hand those areas over to the Syrian Arab army and also remove the Takfiri Daesh people that Turkey has been supporting from perhaps 2011 on, when we remember a lot of the foreign jihadists who entered Syria in order to behead and butcher and crucify and murder Syrian nationals, came through Turkey. Now, if Turkey turns to the position where it is in a rapprochement with Damascus and we have a de facto ceasefire, we will ultimately possibly end up with just the illegal American presence supported by the Kurds in the Syrian, so-called Syrian defense forces. It's possible that the more the country is liberated, the more the Kurds will come under pressure. And I think it is possible that without American backing, the Kurds will fold like a deck of cards. And hopefully going forward, we may find the sovereign nation of Syria intact, but this will take military decisive action against the illegal occupiers and against American forces on the ground, like they did in Baghdad when they bombed the Green Zone, and like they did in Iraq whenever they targeted American convoys. And if you look at the Ansarallah movement in Yemen, I mean, the UAE and Saudi Arabia are trying to steal the oil that belongs to the people of Yemen. And the Ansarallah movement has answered that by threatening the ships and the tankers that would consider removing the oil with being attacked. And when you consider there are shipments nearly every day, trillions of dollars worth of oil has been stolen by the American coalition from the people of Syria and from their elected government in the Syrian Arab Republic.
Thank you. Mohammed Ali joins us now, a correspondent from Damascus, to give us the latest on this attack that has taken place. What do you have for us, Mohammed?
Yes, what we know is that two rockets struck a U.S. Military base, illegally, of course, established in northeastern Syria. U.S. troops in a site called Conoco over there were targeted at about 9 a.m. Local time. This is according to U.S. Central Command. Now, we don't know how many U.S. Forces are actually stationed in that particular base, but what is for sure is that there are several U.S. Illegal U.S. Bases inside Syria. They're occupying many parts in eastern and northeastern Syria. According to the U.S. Central Command, there was no damage and no one was injured, but we cannot make sure about such information or confirm it. This is what the U.S. Central Command said. Also, no one claimed responsibility for this attack. This is yet not the first kind of attack on U.S. Military bases in Syria. And if you ask Syrians on the street or even analysts, they'll tell you that this is a clear and direct message to the U.S. to leave Syria. They are not welcomed over here. They are here illegally without the UN consent or Syrian consent. There is no invitation for the U.S. troops inside Syria. All they did is to divide the country, to prolong the crisis, to destroy Syria. In fact, all of the U.S.-led coalition strikes and attacks and operations in Syria destroyed many cities, also killed civilians over here, also gave support to Daesh terrorists.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The News Review. Thanks for tuning in. Republican lawmakers at the lower house of U.S. Congress are trying to resolve an impasse over choosing a new leader. The chamber has been thrown into chaos with the Republican Party's favorite candidate failing to win the support of hardline members. In the last ballot, California lawmaker Kevin McCarthy fell short of crossing the threshold of 218 votes to become Speaker. That's mainly because far-right Republicans, well, they're arguing that McCarthy is not loyal enough to former U.S. President Donald Trump, who is running for the upcoming presidential election. The lower chamber of the parliament will convene later on Wednesday for further voting. Republicans flipped the House in their favor with a narrow majority after the 2022 midterm elections. And that is it for this edition of World News. Do stay with us. It's bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Will the International Criminal Court begin proceedings against Netanyahu for the crime of apartheid? This question and many others in this regard will be answered in the weeks or months ahead. One thing at least is certain. there will be more pain for Palestinians, even if the Zionist regime supporters, especially the U.S. and its Western and Arab allies, will find it increasingly hard to present a coherent support for the fabricated regime of Israel. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of the Electronic Intifada wrote, 10 human rights groups based in the occupied territories are urging the International Criminal Court's chief prosecutor to visit Palestine and move forward with the investigation opened by his predecessor last year after a years-long preliminary examination. Karim Khan, the court's chief prosecutor, said earlier this month that he aimed to visit Palestine in 2023. His remark during the court's assembly of state parties came amid criticism that his office has stalled the Palestine investigation despite the rapidly deteriorating human rights situation in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. In a letter to Khan, the groups based in state that crimes within the tribunal's jurisdiction have been and are being committed. The organizations, which include Adala, a group that advocates for the rights of Palestinians in the occupied territories, and B'Tselem, which has extensive documentation of Israeli regime's violations, pledged to assist the investigation. The groups noted that the Zionist regime has a record of preventing international access to the territories under its control. It has denied entry to UN investigators and staff members, as well as international scholars and human rights advocates, or forced them to leave, the groups state in their letter to Khan. This context makes your visit and the granting of access to your office ever more important, the groups state. Palestinian human rights groups have expressed frustration that Khan hasn't made any progress on the Palestine investigation. Khan has made no public statement denouncing the Zionist regime's terror group designations and raids targeting the offices of Palestinian human rights groups that have submitted evidence files to the court on behalf of victims. During his visit to Al-Quds in July, U.S. President Joe Biden affirmed that Washington would work with Tel Aviv to combat all efforts to boycott or delegitimize Israel, to deny its right to self-defense, or to unfairly single it out in any forum, including at the United Nations or the International Criminal Court. The U.K., which nominated Khan for the chief prosecutor post, similarly opposes the ICC investigation in Palestine. Despite the state's opposition to the investigation, the Zionist regime's new cabinet is taking aim at its best defense against ICC scrutiny. Itamar Ben-Gvir, a far-right lawmaker in Benjamin Netanyahu's new cabinet, is advancing legislation that would provide legal immunity to Israeli forces and police for their actions during security operations. According to Tel Aviv Daily Haaretz, officials are concerned that such a move would make Israeli soldiers susceptible to prosecution by the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Khan's predecessor, Fatou Bensouda, stated in late 2019 that her office's assessment of the scope and genuineness of the Zionist regime's domestic proceedings remains ongoing at this stage. By doing away with its self-investigation mechanism, albeit one dismissed by B'Tselem as a fig leaf for the occupation, the Zionist regime will be greasing the gears in what otherwise would likely be a major sticking point for the investigation. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime's leaders appear to be daring the ICC to intervene by pledging to advance annexation of land in the West Bank. A similar promise made by Netanyahu during his electoral campaign in 2019 was noted by concern by Bensouda in her request to a pretrial chamber to confirm the court's territorial jurisdiction in the West Bank and Gaza. That same year, Netanyahu was warned by the Zionist Attorney General that formally annexing West Bank land would be indefensible at the ICC and would leave army officials, settlement leaders, and other Israeli regime personnel vulnerable to investigation by The Hague. Recently, Netanyahu has published its guiding principles, which begin with, the Jewish people have an exclusive and unquestionable right over all areas of the land of Palestine, as they claim. There is little ambiguity regarding the new Zionist regime's cabinet intention to deepen the Zionist colonization of Palestinian and Syrian land and consolidate its apartheid rule in all the territory under its control. Palestinians and international human rights groups, including Amnesty International, have called on Khan to investigate the Zionist regime's apartheid. If Khan heeds those calls, Netanyahu could potentially be the first individual ever prosecuted in an international court for the crime of apartheid. Meanwhile, the website of RT wrote in this regard, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry has called on world leaders to reject all dealings with the Zionist regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's new government. The call comes in response to a policy document in which Netanyahu promised to expand Jewish settlements on Palestinian land. According to RT, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry said in a statement recently, the state of Palestine rejects the annexationist, violent, racist, and incitement to ethnic cleansing policy guidelines of Israel's new government, adding that it considers this agenda an existential threat to the Palestinian people and their inalienable and inviolable rights. The international community must carry out its responsibilities and reject any dealings with a government committed to carrying out international crimes, including annexation, political persecution, and racial discrimination, the statement continued.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. When we talk about family and family life, this is a very central part of the Islamic teachings. You know, parents are there out of this love that Allah has created. They take care of the children. You know, they bring them up, raise them, provide for them. They grow up. They get married. They have their own families. By the time they establish their own families, the parents have become old. Now the roles have been reversed. It is the parents now who need the help of the children. But then the problem is, you know, there is now competition there. You are distracted. Your wife and children on one side, the old parents on the other side. That is where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala comes in now, especially talking about the parents in their old age. And what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has done basically is that there are four places where He has combined this issue of kindness to the parents with the most fundamental concept of Islam, which is Tawheed. Sometimes, you know, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants to show the importance of something, He relates it to something else, although they are not connected to one another. Four places. In Surah Baqarah, ayat 83, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about the covenant that He made with the Bani Israel, He says, number one, لا تعبدوا إلا الله. Do not worship anyone but Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is the Tawheed. And then immediately He says, وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا, and be kind to your parents. It's not related to Tawheed. But just to show the importance that, yes, Tawheed is that important, immediately after that He says, be kind to your parents. Surah Nisa, ayat number 36, وَعْبَدُ اللَّهُ وَلَا تُشْرِكْ بِهِ شَيْئًا. You know, worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and do not associate anyone with the divinity of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, with the lordship and rububiyyat of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا. Again, He's talking about Tawheed, then immediately going into the issue of being, you know, kind to the parents. Surah An'am, ayat 151, قُلْ تَعَالَوْ, and this is a passage which we might call the Ten Commandments of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Qur'an. And one of them is where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, O Muhammad, say to them, come to me. I'll tell you what are the things which are haram. And very first one, أَلَّا تُشْرِكُوا بِهِ شَيْئًا. Do not associate anything with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا. And be kind to your parents. And then the fourth one, which is kind of more, you know, in detail. And this is a Surah Bani Israel, Surah number 17, ayat 23-24. This is where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, again, same style. وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَن لَا تَعْبُدُ إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed that you will not worship anyone but Him. وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا. And be kind to your parents. Unlike the other three ayat where Allah then goes to other examples, other commandments, here He goes into detail, especially about the old age of the parents. And He says, and remember, if one of them or both of them, the father and the mother, they become old with you, then what should you do? There are basically three commandments that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives here. And I'm putting here, you know, putting them into three categories in my own language just to make things more simpler. Number one, He talks about the language. The way you talk to your parents. فَلَا تَقُلْ لَهُمَ أُفٍ. Do not even say "uff." Do not even say "oh" to them. You know, we're talking about a situation when people become old, sometimes, you know, they might even become irritating. That's part of the nature of becoming old. Sometimes they might be demanding even more than what you can do. They want things to be done. You might not be able to do the same day. You know, they might be angry. Sometimes I would say they might even blame you for something that you have not done. Maybe somebody else has done it in the family. How do you react to that? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, even in those situations, you're not allowed to say, oh. You know, off. According to Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq, alayhi salatu wa salam, It says in an Arabic language, if there was a word lighter than uff, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala had used that one. Means even this language, we have to be careful. وَلَا تَنْحَرُهُمَا. You know, don't shout at them. وَقُلْ لَهُمَا قَوْلًا كَرِيمًا. And whenever you talk to them, talk with kindness and in the way of respect. So that's number one, the issue of language, how you communicate with them. Number two, what I would call body language. وَخْفِضْ لَهُمَا جِنَاهَ الظُّلَّ مِنَ الرَّحْمَةِ. Always express your humility. The literal translation of these words would be, lower for them your wings of humility out of mercy. What does it mean? It means, you know, sometimes you need to show your own, you know, humility physically. Whether it is, you know, when they come in the room, you stand up, you give your space, for example, or you help them walk a little bit behind, or if they need help, be with them. You know, all different situations, that even the body language is important, which shows respect for them and expresses your humility towards them. And number three, prayers. In life and even after their death. وَقُلْ رَبِّ رَحَمْهُمَا كَمَا رَبَّيَانِي صَغِيرًا. That Allah shower your mercy on them. كَمَا رَبَّيَانِي, as they raised me when I was a child. It's very important to look at some of the words sometimes here. We are addressing Allah as Rabb. Rabbi, my Lord. Or a proper word here, the Rabb would be my provider, my nourisher. This is rububiyyat. And then we use that same, that is the title, Rabb, noun. But when we talk about our parents, we say Rabbayani. That is the verb form of Rabb. Allah is Rabbul Alameen, but the parents, by providing for us and taking care of us, are also, you know, providing. Of course, at a very, very low level here we are talking about. But the importance is to realize that, you know, here we are using that word to say, oh Allah, you are the provider, but you don't necessarily do it directly. You have used the parents to provide for me. And therefore shower your mercy on them the way they raised me when I was infant. And this you do when they are alive as well as when they have passed away.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
The United Nations General Assembly, with the majority of votes in a resolution, requested the advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice regarding the aggressive measures of the Zionist regime of Israel. The simultaneous issuance of this resolution with the official inauguration of the radical and far-right cabinet of Benjamin Netanyahu is very significant. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. English website of the Al Jazeera television network has covered this story. The United Nations General Assembly passed a resolution calling on the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, to give an opinion on the legal consequences of Israel's illegal occupation of Palestinian territories. The UN General Assembly voted 87 to 26, with 53 abstentions on the resolution, with Western nations split but with virtually unanimous support in the Islamic world, including among Arab states that have normalized relations with the Israeli regime. Russia and China voted in favor of the resolution. Israel, the United States, and 24 other members, including United Kingdom and Germany, voted against the resolution, while France was among the 53 nations that abstained. The Hague, Netherlands-based International Court of Justice, ICJ, also known as the World Court, is the top United Nations court dealing with disputes between states. Its rulings are binding, though the International Court of Justice has no power to enforce them. Palestine's United Nations ambassador, Riyad Mansour, noted that the vote came one day after the swearing-in of a new far-right Israeli cabinet, which he said promises an expansion of illegal Zionist settlements and will accelerate colonial and racist policies towards Palestinians. Riyad Mansour also hailed nations that voted in favor of the resolution and were undeterred by threats and pressure. Riyad Mansour told the General Assembly, "We trust that regardless of your vote today, if you believe in international law and believe in peace, you will uphold the opinion of the International Court of Justice when delivered, and you will stand up to this Israeli cabinet right now." The United Nations General Assembly asked the International Court of Justice to give an advisory opinion on the legal consequences of the Israeli regime's occupation, settlement, and annexation, including measures aimed at altering the demographic composition, character, and status of the holy city of Al-Quds, and from its adoption of related discriminatory legislation and measures. The United Nations resolution also asked the International Court of Justice to advise on how those policies and practices affect the legal status of the occupation and what legal consequences arise for all countries and the United Nations from this status. The International Court of Justice, the ICJ, last weighed in on the issue of Israel's occupation back in 2004, when it ruled that Israel's wall in the occupied West Bank and Eastern Al-Quds was illegal. The Israeli regime rejected that ruling, accusing the court of being politically motivated. During the June 1967 war, Israel occupied all of historic Palestine and expelled 300,000 Palestinians from their homes. The Israeli regime also captured Syria's Golan Heights in the north and Egypt's Sinai Peninsula in the south. In 1978, Egypt and Israel signed a peace treaty which led to Israel withdrawing from Sinai. The occupied Palestinian territories have been under Israeli military control since 1967. This makes it the longest occupation in modern history. The segmented territories of Palestine, including the Gaza Strip, the West Bank of the River Jordan, and Eastern Al-Quds. The website dailysabah.com has also covered the same story. Palestinians have welcomed a vote by the United Nations General Assembly, which calls on the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, at The Hague, Netherlands, to give an opinion on the legal consequences of the decades-long Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Israeli annexation, and the legal status of the occupation of Palestinian territories. Nabil Abu Rodeiner, spokesman for Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, said, "The time has come for Israel to be subject to law and to be held accountable for its ongoing crimes against the Palestinian people." Senior Palestinian official Hossein al-Sheikh said on Twitter that Friday's December 30th vote reflects the victory of Palestinian diplomacy. The Palestinian ambassador to the United Nations says a meeting is scheduled to come within days with the legal department of the International Court of Justice, ICJ, to review the documents required for the Hague-based court's opinion on Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories. Riyad Mansour said on Sunday, 1st of January, that the meeting is the next step and that the United Nations General Assembly passing of a resolution recently which called on the International Court of Justice to give an advisory opinion on the consequences of Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands. Palestine's official Wafa news agency said the Palestinian ambassador to the United Nations, Riyad Mansour, said the International Court of Justice will examine the legal implications of the continued Israeli occupation of our land, including the deprivation of our people of their rights, settlement construction, annexation of land, and Palestinian home demolitions by the Israeli regime. The Palestinian envoy to the United Nations, Riyad Mansour, also pointed out that an open session of the UN Security Council will be held at the end of the month to discuss this latest developments in the occupied Palestinian territories. Zvika Fugel, a far-right lawmaker in the Israeli coalition cabinet, said the occupation of Palestinian territories was permanent, at least as of right now, in response to the United Nations vote on Friday, 30th of December. Zvika Fugel said, "As of right now, the occupation is permanent, and as of right now, I would like to continue to apply Israeli sovereignty over all the areas that I can," adding that he supports the Israeli plans to annex the occupied West Bank. The Al-Ahad television network has also reported on the same story. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemned the United States' unwavering support for the Israeli regime, saying United Nations resolutions concerning Palestine will not be implemented as long as Tel Aviv enjoys Washington's full support. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem made the remark in a statement on Saturday, 31st of December, after the United Nations General Assembly approved a resolution in favor of Palestinians. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem said the resolution will add to the long list of international resolutions concerning Palestine, which have never turned into a practical step to put pressure on the occupying Israeli regime. As long as the United States acts as a partner of the occupying Israeli regime and covers up Israeli crimes, all such decisions will remain just on paper. Recently, Palestinian Minister of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates Riyad al-Maliki announced that the UN General Assembly has adopted a resolution that affirms the Palestinian people's right to self-determination. Riyad al-Maliki further called on the international community to work on obliging Israel to implement international resolutions and guarantee the right of the Palestinian people, as he hailed the resolution. The United Nations General Assembly also adopted 5 resolutions recently in favor of Palestinians, including the issue of Palestinian refugees. These decisions are issued every year by the UN General Assembly, which consists of 193 member states. However, the resolutions are non-binding. British diplomat Thomas Phipps said of Friday's United Nations vote. Phipps said, "We do not feel that a referral to the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, is helpful in bringing the parties back to dialogue." Thomas Phipps claimed, "It is also the position of the United Kingdom that it is inappropriate without the consent of both parties to ask the court at The Hague, Netherlands, to give an advisory opinion in what is essentially a bilateral dispute." Among Western nations that backed the resolution was Portugal, whose representative said the World Court underpins the international rule-based order which we seek to preserve.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A few strive in the cause of God, victory will definitely follow. The following is a part of the speech delivered on June 28, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of top officials and employees of the judiciary. Those who, if it granted them power in the land, will maintain the prayer, give the zakat, and enjoin good and forbid evil. Chapter 22, verse 41. Keeping our prayers means offering prayers. This verse says that a divine Islamic government should increase worshipping, attention to God, and attention to spirituality among the people. The offering of prayers is for this purpose, so the spirit of worship must increase in the Islamic Republic. And giving the zakat means paying the poor rate. We all know what zakat is. The point about this reference to giving the zakat, which has been mentioned in various places in the Quran, is this, that spreading justice is desirable in the Islamic society. This is how it is. Now, what about enjoining good? In prayer, zakat and the like, some things have been done, but we are lagging behind in enjoining good and forbidding evil. Amrun bil ma'ruf wa nahyun 'anil munkar. What is good? Justice, fairness, brotherhood, and Islamic values are good.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
We must enjoin good. In our constitution, one of the duties mentioned in Article 8 is the issue of enjoining good and forbidding evil. Forbidding evil means evil should be forbidden. What is evil? It is oppression. It is corruption. It is discrimination. It is injustice. It is disobedience to God. These are all kinds of oppression. These are evils which should be forbidden. So these are duties. Enjoining good and forbidding evil are duties, just like prayer and zakat are duties. According to a tradition, enjoining good is higher than all other divine duties, even higher than jihad. This is Nahjul Balagha, Wisdom 374. We do not want to go into these details at this time. In any case, this is a duty. It is also one of the duties of the judiciary. If we do not carry out this duty, it will be a blow to ourselves. You have the opportunity to do this now. In referring to the judiciary, I mean the judiciary of the country.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.